I'm basically just going to introduce Evan. Let me get everybody's attention for a second. Stop talking to your neighbor. Yes, how about some glass chiming noise? Thank you. Excellent. Keeps me from having to scream. I'm gonna as we do this transition, I'm actually just going to jump in and introduce Evan Goldstein, who is a friend, among other things, a master sommelier, and a fantastic writer and talker about food and wine together, as would befit a master sommelier. He's the author of a number of books, among them Perfect Pairings, which came out about 4 years ago, which includes what to pair with Pinot Noir, among other things. Daring Pairings, his most recent book, is it's essentially about pairing wine with pairing food with completely esoteric grape varieties. It's the advanced level course, but he's witty, he's terrific, he's smart, and he's an expert on this, and someone that I have enormous respect for. So Evan Goldstein.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you so much. What a treat to be here, Ray. We should go on the road and just do this all the time. I don't think it gets any better than that. It's an honor, a pleasure to be with all of you here today, sharing a great subject in Pinot Noir, a great subject in Pinot Noir with food. And I simply want to thank the folks here at the IPNC for having me up here again. I was actually at the first two of these events, 23 and 24 years ago, and haven't been back since. I don't know what that says, but it was it's great. It was obviously as soon as the invitation came out, I was quick to jump on it. I would just that before we actually get started, I was just doing a little bit of sort of theorem stuff, and this seminar is entitled Wine is Food, which is great. If you're a cook, how many of you are avid cooks out there, enjoy cooking, and a lot of it? Food is love. I mean, food is all about the giving. It's all about the nurturing. It's all about that. It's not about the competition. I'll wax against that in a few minutes, which means that wine equals love, right? So food is wine is food, and food is love, then wine is love. I thought that worked out just beautifully. Pinot Noir with food is a real easy one, if you will. For many, many years, sommeliers have sort of considered it to be their silver bullet. It's what sits in their holster when they have that table of four or five people where one's got a veal chop, this one's got tuna, this one has ossobuco, and this one has pasta, and they're trying to find the one wine that'll pull it all together, and you haven't magically spoken them into two or three bottles or an avid wine by the glass program. Pinot Noir is really safe. It's easy. It works with just about everything, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. In fact, back in the day when my family and myself had Square One Restaurant back in the late 80s, mid-80s in San Francisco, we actually did a relatively, at the time, radical thing, which was to have essentially two times as many Pinot Noirs on our list as we did Cabernets, which, as you can imagine, being in the backyard of the Napa Valley back then was considered sacrilege, and I had to fight off many a hitman over time. But time has vindicated me, and I think, as we all are aware of, Pinot Noir is a very malleable grape with food, not only in its red iteration, but also as a sparkling wine, also as a rosé, etc. And there's a couple of reasons for that. However, before I talk about that and before the chefs do their last-minute magic and the food comes out here, I think it's really important that we do circle back on a concept that was brought up earlier by Ray and the panel, which is this whole idea of wine alone and wine with food, because I think it's a really important thing. I believe that wine's place is at table with food, with your friends, with your family. That's where the memories are created. That's where the enjoyment of it is. And we tend to get very analytical about wine, very comparative, very competitive at times. And wines that, as I think, were brought out, oftentimes that show well in the context of being tasted by themselves amongst other wines or by itself just chatting with friends, are not necessarily going to translate at table exactly the same way. Wines that are, how many of you have had the experience of having an enjoyable wine, perhaps even an enjoyable Pinot Noir, and then going to table and then the wine just sort of disappeared on you when the food came out? Yeah, you're nodding your head. And then how many of you have had wines before that you were served and all that, and you taste the wine and you think, oh, my God, I wouldn't wash my car with this stuff, only to be chagrined to find out that that was the same wine being served at dinner, yet when the food came out and you plugged your nose and went in, it was actually better than when it was by itself. So wines, depending on the context of them, you know, are not necessarily going to equate completely from a soloist to a group performer. And I think oftentimes Pinot Noirs, particularly with folks who are not necessarily the rabid folks that you are, who are learning about wines, find Pinot Noir a bit difficult because it is a wine that really is perhaps more so than almost any other grape architected to go seamlessly with food. And that's a concept that I call and allude to in all of my writings is this idea of mapping wine. And that is to say that, you know, we're talking about Pinot Noir, but if you were to sort of take Pinot Noir, forget about it for a minute, hard to do, but well, just for a second, for just the purpose of illustration, and realize that, you know, if you can use this system regardless of grape, regardless of country of origin, regardless of whatever, because all grapes and all wines, if you will, share these five basic building blocks of acid, sugar, oak, tannin, and alcohol. And the beauty of this is that, you know, while we sit here and wax, you know, about, oh, the gingery character, and did you get the coriander in this, and isn't this wonderful sort of truffly cocoa thing coming out for you, and we're, oh, okay. But, you know, all those other things can be metrically quantified. You know, you can take a glass of water with a squeeze of lemon and pure lemon juice, and notice that the acid levels increase. You could take a glass of water, 50-50 vodka water and vodka, and notice that the alcohol levels increase. Water, Splenda in water, simple syrup, sugar increases. And you could do that for oak, and you could do that for tannin via black tea being oversteeped. So things that people can actually metrically quantify and measure become actually very useful in the whole idea of guidelining through and trying to explain what pairings are all about. Because once you understand what high acid versus low acid or insufficient or flabby acid means to a food pairing, once you understand what dry versus off-dry versus sweet means to a food pairing, et cetera, with alcohol, et cetera, with tannin, et cetera, with oak, then it becomes, this jigsaw puzzle becomes a lot easier. And I believe that if you look at how Pinot Noir maps in your mouth, again, exceptions to the rule, but as a general rule, it's based on a higher acidity level. I think Lynette pointed that out earlier. And acidity is without question the singularly most important aspect of wine's architecture to pair with food as far as it goes. It's got balanced oak. It's usually not over oak, which is gorgeous. The tannins are supple, present, but not over heavy-handed. Obviously, it's a dry wine, and the alcohol levels are usually moderate. Again, it's a cool climate grape. So that is actually the perfect architecture when you learn more about wine and food pairing, as we'll talk about when the dishes come out as we taste the wines, that make the whole thing fly. It's what clicks it into place, if you will. So it really is the magic. That's why for years, you know, you've always said, when this one's having chicken, and this one's having fish, and this one's having lamb, and they're three relatively disparate proteins, and you want them to all go together, very few wines can pull them together the way that Pinot Noir can because of the acid, the lower tannins, the balanced oak, and all of those other good things. So what I thought we would do before the chefs get out here is just sort of give you a sense of what the guidelines for this exercise are. So you might want to reference your sheet in front of you. And I will reference the directions. When we started putting this together months back, and we have been working on this for a while, we thought about, you know, how it could be. So before I get into the actual thing, the activation of something like this for as many people as we have in this room with four different chefs, as you can imagine, is a little bit challenging. So the basic things that we said were, one, everything that you've got needs to be able to be served room temperature because we cannot be dependent on timing of when you're going to take a dish, is it going to be perfectly warm, et cetera, et cetera. So it had to be served at room temperature. Two, anything that was accompanying it, i.e. a sauce or a condiment or something like that, had to be the genre of which would not congeal in front of your eyes and look unappetizing, and not only that, lose the integrity of what its role is with the lamb that it's being served with. Number three, that we could serve all the dishes on a single dish. So we're, you know, much as we would like to think we have time for four courses of lamb, which would be fun at about 11 in the morning, we aren't able to do that. And then lastly, obviously, I talked to all the chefs, and, you know, they've been keened in or tuned in to sort of like if you are vegetarian or you don't like to do that, how you might want to think about that. So that was sort of one of the things that we did as they come here. The second thing that we did long before Chopped existed on the Food Network, there was a gentleman by the name of Robert Courtin in France who used to write a book annually called La Cuisine de Saison or something like that. And what he would do is he would give Michelin-starred chefs a pain panier, a basket, if you will, of ingredients that were associated with a particular season, and they had to come up with a three, I see heads nodding, people remember back 20 or 30 years, they would have to come back with a three-course meal based on what was simply in the basket. So this is not something that was created by media, but it's been around for a long time. That's important because, as we know, food is about season. As much as we've talked about this whole concept of terroir being true and that site trumps clone, I think people will tell you that even when you're dealing with food, it's seasonal, it's different, it depends on if it's an animal, what it ate, what time of the year it was slaughtered, etc. With vegetables and fruits, you know, tomatoes in the middle of July right now are a very gorgeous thing compared to, say, February, not quite as nice. Cheeses have seasons. All of these things have seasons. So that's something that, you know, we needed to take into consideration as well in putting this together. So all of the chefs had basic, what we called primary ingredients and then secondary ingredients. So everybody is working with lamb. Now, lamb, by the way, is as complex as Pinot Noir, right? You cannot just say lamb as a statement, just like the way you can't say Pinot Noir as a statement, because we know that's a bit glib. Lamb is going to vary depending on the provenance of the lamb. Lamb that you're having, say, here in America, and thank you to the American lamb people for being so generous and working with us today, is a different animal, no pun intended, than the lamb that you're going to find down in New Zealand or in Australia, where they have quite a few sheep as well, too. So that, the diet of them, the provenance of them will change the flavor. Then the cut of the lamb is going to affect that as well, too. So one of the decisions we made early on was to assign everybody a different cut to work with. So that is sort of what they were starting with. Then they have some basic primary ingredients that everybody's allowed to work with. So you had your basic aromatics of carrots, celery, onions, garlic, mirepoix, all those things, olive oil, butter, etc., and cooking liquids and all those things that would be standard, pantry materials, if you will. Then we gave them a list, if you will, a panier of ingredients, of which you see down there, from fruits to various vegetables, starches, herbs, spices, and then acids, including verjus and pickles and balsamic vinegars and things like that, acid being a very critical component in the matching with that, and asked them to select 3 to 5, no more. I guess 5 would be all of them, but, you know, to try and give them some freedom to match and go with there, and then come up with a dish that would work with the wine. So each of them has been working diligently, has obviously had the wine that they were assigned and the winemaker that they are assigned to put this together. But they're also getting, by the way, the firsthand opportunity, as you are, to try everybody else's dishes. So as I introduce the chefs and as we go through the program here, I would suggest 2 things. One, obviously, we're going to give everybody a couple of seconds, maybe 20, 30 seconds, to sort of taste the wine and the food without talking to you at the same time, because that can be a little bit confusing as you're trying to actually pay attention to what's going on. But as we move through along the way, as you've done such an excellent job, I might add, saving your wines here, I would ask you, when we get there, to not only taste the wine with the food, but later on when we've gone through everything, if you haven't hoovered all of the food and all of the wine in front of you, to actually go back and mix and match. You know, while these have been designed and architected for specific things, Pinot's beauty, if you will, is in its the diversity of it. And by the way, it's the only grape, I don't know about all of you, but it drives me crazy. You know, when you're sitting there talking about wine and food, you go into stores, you know, you go shopping, and you pick up and read back labels. You know, and every back label in America basically says the same thing. And by the way, most of the people who do back label have never actually eaten the wine with the food that they're doing. But amazingly, that every wine in America goes with salt, it goes with pasta, fish, squab, veal, lamb, everything. Isn't it amazing how all wines do that? The only wine that can successfully get away with that? Pinot Noir. So we'll talk about it a little bit. So let me introduce the chefs here, and then we'll start as the food is, I believe, we'll sort of drag here a little bit as the food is being plated and placed down. But we have 3 chefs who are local, if you will, from Portland, and one who is an annexed local from Seattle up north. And I don't see how my labels are from left. I don't know if we're necessarily in order, but I'm going to go down the order that I have them. Kevin Gibson. Kevin is over here. Kevin is with Evo Restaurant in Portland. And again, I'm not going to read the bios and on timing, but these people all have bios that are definitely worth reading. They are in your booklets. I would encourage you to read them. And they all have illustrious careers, tremendous backgrounds, and share not only a passion for food, but a passion for localness in their food as well, too. So this whole locavore movement, important to grapes, important to your food as well, too. Renee Erickson. Renee is from Boat Street Cafe up in Seattle. She is our annexed local today, and we'll be hearing from her as well. Jason Stoller-Smith on my left here is with the Dundee Bistro and Timberline Lodge in Timberline, Oregon. And then last and certainly not least, in Portland, is Kathy Wims from Nostrana. So you'll notice that each of them has been assigned a very specific cut as well, too. So not only are we going to be tasting lamb with four different wines, but we're going to be tasting four different cuts of lamb with that and addressing how the issues and the idiosyncrasies and all of that good stuff work together. So we don't have everything in front of us. So what I am going to do, and just in filling that, because I think it would be unfair to sort of prance off when half of you are able to play and half of you are not able to play yet, let me talk a little bit as we lead into this context of pairing wine and food with this idea that two things have happened. One, I sort of quickly went over this whole idea of mapping the wine and food together, i.e. if you understand, I teach sommeliers and teach anybody who's interested in learning it, that you should be able to taste a glass of wine, measure it by its acid, alcohol, tannin, oak, and sugar, and get a little thumbprint, the DNA of that wine, and start to be able to think about what kind of food you want to go with it and why, based on this sort of juxtaposition of individual qualities. Having said that, that's sort of like being the, you know, half of the lingual in bilingual. The other reality of the lingual is, of course, the food. And what all good chefs will ask themselves as they're creating dishes, as they're thinking iteratively about dishes, is there's three basic aspects or keys, if you will, to food, just as there are these five keys to wine. And those keys are, one, the ingredient, the primary driver or ingredients, if there happens to be multiple. In this particular case, it's lamb, so we will know that. But the secondary things and where they get their opportunity to play, much as winemakers get to play with clones and oaks and all those other good things, chefs get to play by virtue of cooking methods, which can range from the absolutely neutral, from raw. Nobody's doing chosen to do lamb carpaccio, but one could have, I suppose, all the way up to, you know, grilling or smoking and things like that that can heavily impact the flavor of the primary ingredient. And then third, certainly last but not least, is this concept of condimenting or saucing. As a dish is constructed, as it's layered together, what you'll find is you try a dish that usually one to two of those elements will stand up. One is, if you will, the alpha male or alpha female of the pack of contexts that go together in putting together a dish. And understanding which is the alpha male or alpha female in that dish, whether it is a specific flavor coming from a sauce, whether it is a very strong cooking method, or whether it is the integrity of that ingredient itself, will help you sort of find that key to latch on to when you do your actual pairing. Okay? So that's something I want you to hold on in your head. That will be something that we come up and talk about as we move forward. So we're still working ahead, but what I think I will do in the absence of not having food in front of you is perhaps just go around the table and ask each of our chefs to give us sort of just a general think about how you approach it. Do you approach it in a wine and food thing like this? Do you approach it, is the wine important that you have an understanding of what that's all about and then do the food, or are you looking to really create your food and then think about the right kind of wine to go with it? And then by the time hopefully we get through that, all of us love our food and we'll be able to go. So Kathy, why don't you start?
So I had shank and lamb shank, which is, as everybody probably knows, it takes like long, slow, moist cooking. And I had what I thought was a really big wine, but very, very complex. And I think in slow, moist cooking and stewing and braising, there's a lot of flavor levels. In Italian cooking, it's called insaporito, which is to infuse flavor in various different additions to a dish. And to me, the wine that I was paired with was like perfect for that because it had so many different layers and levels. So I was really super excited. And so this is a braised lamb shank with taken off the bone after it's braised, cooked in white wine. It's actually a variation of a recipe from Evan's mother, Joyce Goldstein, from Cucina Ebraica. It's braised in white wine with carrots, onions, a tiny bit of cinnamon, a tiny bit of toasted cumin, and what else? Green olives, Castelvetrano olives. And then it's finished with some sautéed tomatoes, which I think I've always thought were verbotum with Pinot Noir, but Mark Vlasic encouraged me to to be a little wild and took me out of my comfort zone. So we'll see how those go. So they're my fruit in this thing. And there's a tiny gremolata that has Italian parsley, orange rind, and this crazy herb from Mark Vlasic's garden, which is a Lebanese coriander.
Mm-hmm. Great. And again, we'll sort of go through these, and obviously when the food comes out, we'll taste it. From your standpoint, Jason, what's sort of your thinking again on that?
My thinking with doing food and wine pairing, I'm hoping to create a pairing and a marriage between the two flavors, between the food and the wine, that not only makes the wine taste better or the food taste better, but to try to elevate both things so that they both taste better together. With the lamb leg that I prepared today, we smoked the lamb leg over grapevines, over Pinot Noir grapevines from Sokol Blosser Vineyards. And it was just long and slow this morning for 2 hours total time over smoke. There's a mint salsa verde with the lamb leg that I tried to keep nice and subtle because there was a nice subtle mint tones with the wine that I believed. And then with the Amarena cherries on top.
Excellent. Renee, your approach?
I actually always start with the dish, so it was a bit of a challenge to switch my way of thinking. My wine is the Pinot Noir from New Zealand, and it was delicious and very bright and had good acidity and a lot of berry fruit. And I actually did a few test runs and found that I was going to try to go with blackberries, but found it was too similar. So I chose to kind of have the lentils as an earthiness and then roasted the lamb on the grill after Jason with kind of like an herb de Provence, so a dry herb rub with olive oil, and then had a relish made with plum and preserved lemon and olive oil. So real simple, bright flavors to go along with the brightness of the wine.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Kevin, your general thinking before we get into the specifics.
Good morning.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's okay.
That's okay. Pass along.
Yeah.
I had shoulder, and after tasting the Burgundy, trying to figure out how to, it seemed like a very subtle, delicate wine, and I tried to do the lamb the same way, just kind of let the lamb do itself. There's some dried persimmon in there to provide the fruit, and there's a lot of thyme in there also, because I felt the wine had a little bit of it's a whole stem, so you can get a little bit of that tannin from that, I think, and also the currant, I think, kind of reflects on the wine, too. It had some tea notes to it and a slight herbaceousness to it, and we'll see if it all works. You start up here sometimes, and then hopefully it follows through. But
I think it's important to realize that, you know, when you're putting food and wine matches together, and we've got just another minute before these last tables get their food, is twofold. It's very hard for both people to be stars, or both aspects of things to be stars at the same time. I always say there's sort of four kinds of food and wine matches out there. One, the unmitigated disaster. And, you know, you've probably experienced this at some point in your life, hopefully not with Pinot Noir, but you know when you sort of taste the Epicurean equivalent of sticking a fork in an electric socket, not to do it again. So we thought about doing that up here, but thought if we just gave you four really crummy matches, you would probably never come back again and throw the remainder of your food at us. So we opted out of that. The second matches are what I would sort of refer to as kind of the Switzerland or Costa Rica factor matches, which is to say very neutral in nature, which is to say, you know, and I think you were even alluding to that, Renee, I could have done the berries and gone this way, but it was very safe. And safe can be very important. If you have a large group of people, or you're working at an event with folks you don't know, or you're, you know, doing a wine and food thing at a wedding or something like that, you want to be safe because you don't know necessarily where people's palates are. I can tell you by virtue of us being here with our love of food and our love of Pinot Noir that we didn't really necessarily want to go that safe route. So I'm sure there's going to be safe aspects of things, but that's not necessarily the way to go. The third is what I refer to affectionately as the Ocean's 11 factor. How many of you saw Ocean's 11, the remake? Okay, now that was a fun movie, but I really didn't get it until the third or fourth time I saw it, because if you've got all these amazing actors and actresses at the same time, all of whom are headliners in and of themselves, it's hard to look at the individual performances and the nuances or the detail, as Dan was saying earlier, when you've got all this going on. Then you throw food at it, and it's absolute cacophony. So oftentimes food and wine pairings get marred in the fact that they're trying to be too edgy, too hard, too much at the same time. So finding that happy space, if you will, the sweet spot between two and three is usually the way to go. And then fourth, certainly not least, is what we would call epiphany, the 1 + 1 = 3. Now, very much like category one of unmitigated disaster, category four, which in this case is better than a category four storm, is magic. But it's really hard to recreate it. Even if you do the same recipes, the same wines, the same people, and the same place, the moment has changed. You've lost the moment. So don't expect necessarily epiphany to happen for you today. If it does, embrace it, love it, and remember it. Because, you know, it's impossible to recreate. So that's just, again, a little bit more context as we're moving through there. So food and wine matches, and one playing back to one playing the other. The other thing I would just tell you, only a few more to go, is that in moving through food and wine matches, as you want to really hone these and get them to work beautifully, the best single thing to do, and I know this is going to be tough for all of you, is to drink while you're cooking. All right, which is to say, as you are putting the dish together, be tasting the wine on a constant basis. Not only does it make the cooking more fun, but it actually allows you to adjust for the dish within that. Remember that wine is fixed. There's nothing you can do to change the acid, oak, tannin, alcohol, or acidity in the wine, but food can be flexible, and you have a little bit more freedom to play something up or down, add in another ingredient, etc., to nuance that. So we now have all the food coming out. I am assuming that everyone's orientation of 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 9 o'clock is exactly the same. So not knowing what it is from not being able to see it, you all, the chefs, probably know whose exactly is whose. Who has 12 o'clock? Do we know? Kevin? So, Kevin, why don't you start with us? And again, what I'd like everybody to do before we get started is take just maybe a little bit of time, a moment here, and try the wine by itself. Remind yourself of the flavor. Try the wine again with the food, obviously, and get your arms around what's going on there. And then, Kevin, if you'd like to talk a little bit about deeper about your thinking on that, and I'll have a couple questions to throw out as well, too. So everybody try 12 o'clock with the designated wine.
So are the wines blind?
The wines, oh, I'm sorry, the wines are not blind. The wines that you, I forgot this, they don't know. The wines moving from left to right are, first of all, your name is associated below, so you'll see your chef's name, but we have the French Burgundy, followed by the Dutton Goldfield, followed by the New Zealand wine, and finishing up with the, no?
New Zealand second,
sorry. Okay, France, New Zealand, California, and finishing up in Oregon, all right? So again, just try that match, and then we'll go from there.
Right. So start at the top of the plate.
So you're going to be
right. Yeah, the top. They were turning the plate.
Yeah. So don't change the orientation of your plate. Keep it as a diamond as it was laid out in front of you, because if not, you're going to get confused. So you should be at 12 o'clock now with Kevin's dish.
The pâté should be on the top of the
plate. The pâté should be on the top, yeah.
With the sauce. Lamb for breakfast, right?
All right. So. Absolutely. Kevin, why don't you describe the dish and remind people of it as we're actually tasting it, and then we'll move into the pairing.
Well, there were, one, it was to make it easy to plate today. I've never really done these kind of numbers before, so I hope you all enjoy that. Well, again, along with Kathy, the shoulder, you can't really do like these guys did. It has to be braised. In this case, it was poached and then just sliced today. Are you picking up any of the herbaceous thing in there, or use more thyme, perhaps? Or I'm just curious what the winemaker thinks of it. So
we're just beginning to
yeah, a lot of lamb there. So.
So Kevin, while they're going through it, can you tell us what's unique about shoulder when you're thinking about preparing it? What, you know, compared to other parts of lamb, do you take into consideration in creating a dish?
So, thing they can use either in stew or in a case like this, some sort of pate, because there's enough fat in there on its own, whereas leg might be slightly lean for this preparation. And again, mostly a lot of it was for my ease of doing this today. Mm-hmm. So I get it all done ahead of time instead of, you know, right, braising it and making a stew. So.
And would if you were working with a different varietal, say, I don't know, Nebbiolo or Zinfandel, as opposed to Pinot Noir with this braising, would you have approached it in a different way?
I think I would certainly bumped up more of the, because right now it's just kind of about the lamb and keeping the subtlety there. I think if you mentioned Zinfandel, it would be certainly a whole different thing. I think you just amp everything up. You get away with more coriander, garlic, more herbs, definitely. So, mm-hmm. And maybe even cooking it with much more wine involved, too, or red wine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you can go, I mean, it's kind of a do whatever you kind of like, you know, but again, I think it's mostly about the wine here today, so just to keep it delicate and as subtle as possible. So,
do you think that then in working with lamb and in working with shoulder that lends itself particularly well to Pinot, or did you find this to be a bit of a stretch for you, Kevin?
My first thought when I heard about this was, oh, duck or quail, beef perhaps, but lamb, I think more of, you know, Bordeaux or mm-hmm. Southern French kind of thing, or rosé perhaps, but no, it's not my first thing to think about, but mm-hmm. I think it's fun to try it that way, though, yeah, so good. Try something different, so.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Has everybody had an opportunity to try the match? Yeah, to go through it? I think we've got all of our tables there. Again, this is the beauty of these things is they should be iterative and all that. Any thoughts, any comments, any
no rights or wrongs here. Just
yeah,
there, guys...
it's the beauty of it. It is very personal. So, yeah, on the end.
Perfect.
Okay, yeah, cool. So the thought was on one of the assigned wines that perhaps it was a little bit overwhelming, but once again, feel free to sort of mix and match and play around. It's hard to not do that when you have four beautiful wines in front of you to sort of riff off of. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Any other questions? You're just hungry? It is, yeah, okay, all right. Well, let's move to our next wine. We're going in absolute order. Renee, why don't we go with yours next? And I presume you're at 3 o'clock, correct?
3 o'clock, yes.
All right.
So, again, I had a very bright and juicy Pinot, and I wanted to try to have something that would not compete with that, but kind of balance with that. It has a nice acidity to it, and the lentils I just kept really simple. We just cooked them with carrot and onion and celery, and then cooled them and tossed them with olive oil and salt and pepper so that they were just a real earthy base to the lamb. And the lamb is rubbed with the dry rub of rosemary, thyme, tarragon, salt and pepper, and olive oil. And we just grilled that. I actually grilled second, so I kind of got the easy spot this morning. And the plum was just to try to have another brightness with the acidity, and there's some thyme into that to add to the earthiness. And I have not tried it with it yet, but mm-hmm. you can tell me if it goes okay.
Well, as you're trying it, what are your thoughts? Again, you know, I asked Kevin about sort of the uniqueness and how, from a wine standpoint, you would approach shoulder. Loin is, of course, a very
right.
different cut.
Loin the fat is very lean, little fat, and which by nature, I have a French restaurant, so we love fat, and I wanted to the limitations of the ingredients I felt a little challenging, but it was kind of a good challenge to try to put towards myself as far as what, you know, how to complement the two and be limited in what we had. I could have been the carpaccio, I guess. I should have thought about that, but I think, you know, lamb loin is, you know, I sort of had the same feeling as far as what I would traditionally cook with lamb would be much more spicier things, lots of like paprika or different kinds of chilies and things, which of course is not, I think, a fair pairing to Pinot. So I would have, you know, my hunch would have been to go to the south of France and had, you know, something from the Languedoc or something like that. But I you know, I think the brightness is really nice with all the fruit that you paired with the ingredient list. So.
And how specifically do you, you know, in dealing with a cut that is loin, which is, you know, obviously juicier but not as much fat, how does that change your thinking vis-a-vis Pinot as opposed to other cuts of lamb?
How does it change my thinking? I don't know that it does. I think I think for me it was just you know, I thought a lot of, I mean, more than I probably normally would as far as pairing stuff, because I think as cooks that, you know, are aware of how wine pairs with foods, you just sort of, you kind of learn what you think goes well or what you like to eat with things, so you kind of have a natural, you know, lean towards certain things. So for me, it was just, I really wanted it to be something that made sense with the wine, and so, and I think generally I start more with the food, so to work backwards a little bit was a good challenge.
Okay. Any thoughts? And then I'm actually going to ask the winemakers to sort of maybe comment about what they think on the pairings of with their wines as well. To any other general questions from the audience as well? You're so quiet. Are you just hungry? Is that what it is? You're just like enjoying your... I see a hand over here. There's a mic that will be traveling so we don't have to have you scream.
Do you have recipes available for us for this, for the wine? I mean, for the lamb?
I think they're going to get sent to you later. Yeah. I think everyone's going to get the recipes mailed to them. Yeah. What?
The recipes will be posted online, Whitney. Is that it? Okay, so if you go to the website later on, you will certainly be able to find them. Any other questions? Yeah, in the back over there in the blue shirt. I feel like an auctioneer. And the gentleman in the back in the blue shirt. There's a mic coming.
Well, it's great that we have all these like nuanced tastes, but what we're typically hit with at home is we have a bottle which has been sitting in the cellar for 10 years, and we pull it out, and how do we know whether to cook it with loin or cook it with shoulder when once we open it, it's the moment's lost.
Yeah. If I could address that, and it's probably less true for Pinot than it is for a lot of the other big red varietals that have, you know, the ample tannins and the ample oak and all that, is wine does change over time. And probably the most vivid experience I ever had is years ago I was in Spain, in Rioja, as a matter of fact. And if you know you're in Rioja, you're in the land of lamb, of course. So, you know, you're having lamb basically breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's kind of like Groundhog Day, the movie, in real life. And we went to a particular producer, and what they're showing you generally is usually one wine. It is Rioja, but it's ranging from Joven, which is juicy grape juice on steroids without oak, all the way to their Grandes Reservas, which have spent ample time in oak and ample time in bottle. And to do this as a progression, and to do it in this particular case with only lamb, meant that they actually had to sort of move around with cuts and move around with cooking techniques. And what this particular chef and gentleman explained to me was that with the younger wines, the juicier wines, and especially some of the unoaked wines, that you were oftentimes better off going with braises and long cooks and things like that, because what you would essentially kind of cooked out over time, if you will, that the wine would fill in the gaps, much like Meunier does with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and a sparkling wine. And then for the older wines, where the fruit was a little bit more evolved and the wine had developed more vinosity, to have some of the more juicier loins and things like that was a beautiful way, because in this case, the meat would fill in what Mother Nature had taken out about time. So for me, I'll sort of adjust cuts and cooking methods based oftentimes on age of the wine, you know, obviously at extremes. Okay? Let's move on next to Jason, and he's, as he's eating here, he's got a food, mouthful of food. Your wine and your thoughts on the dish and how you were doing it is, I'm sure people have moved ahead and are tasting.
Sure. The Dutton Goldfield that I was trying, I always taste with some friends to get everybody's input on it, but we picked up a little black pepper, some mint, and some red fruit, coming off of the wine. And so I was just trying to kind of pair up with that. So in keeping that in mind is when we came up with the dish. So with the lamb leg, we really rubbed it really aggressively with fresh ground pepper and let that sit overnight. Rubbed it with salt first to get a little salt penetration on the leg, and then with cracked black pepper. Then we saw, I always like barbecuing and like adding smoke to my meat. So we smoked them over the grapevines, sliced them thin. And then I just did a little mint salsa verde, added a little bit of lemon zest and some lemon juice just to give it a little bit of acidity with some onions as well. And tried to keep the mint level really minimal on it. I just wanted it to just be a little bit of that in the back of your palate, tasting a little bit of that mint to pair up with the wine, but not be overly aggressive with it at all. And then the Amarena cherry is just nice and simple on top. I like the sweetness from it to go with the wine, the fruitiness of the wine as well.
And what do you and your thinking and your sort of ideation in this, what's sort of relatively unique to leg in this case versus the other cuts, and how did that work with your ideation on the creation of your dish?
We trimmed a lot of the fat off of the leg because I just wanted the smoke flavor and the black pepper flavor to get into the meat as much as possible. And to really just focus more on the meat flavor without all the fat that goes along with the leg as well, especially when you're barbecuing and cooking it.
Mm-hmm. And if you had a different wine, once again, say a Nebbiolo or Syrah or Zinfandel, would you have approached it in a different way?
I think I would have approached it a different way, but try to be more aggressive with the flavors. With Pinot, I tend to try to keep everything nice and subtle and not to overwhelm the wine. But with a larger red wine especially, I would have gone a lot more aggressive with acidity and with the flavor profile as well.
Okay. Any questions or thoughts or comments on this particular pairing or thought? Yeah, there's a hand way over there in the back.
With sparkling rosé?
So a rosé sparkling wine or a rosé wine made in a Frizzante style? That would be my question. A sparkling rosé. So, okay. I mean, I have my thoughts. We can certainly ask the panel as well, too. Like, was that question addressed to Jason originally or just to everyone in general? Anyone in general?
Thank you.
Does anyone of the chefs want to take it first, and then I can jump in? The question was if you were dealing with sparkling rosé, a sparkling rosé-style wine and lamb,
so
how much you...
You'd put through the fat, it would
yeah.
be like this, but...
Yeah. Again, the sort of general thinking up here is that the acidity that you find in sparkling wine, obviously in concert with the effervescence, gives you a tremendous refreshment factor, can cut through fat, can cleanse the palate, which works beautifully with a lot of styles. I think it's going to work well as well because of relatively lower alcohols with fairly forceful preparations. But once again, you have to pay attention, as I think Jason said before, to the subtlety of flavors in that and not kind of overwhelm it and override it, which a lot of us who like bold flavors have a tendency to want to do. Any other comments specific to Jason's pairing here? Yeah, over here on the side.
For me, so far, this was the most transformative pairing, uh-huh. where the food and the wine really sort of became one, as opposed to being very separate components. Mm-hmm. Although I do think that the addition of the cherry really takes it in a direction that I did not prefer. I preferred to try it without the cherry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the beauty of things like this is, and hence the whole idea of playing around with them, and as I always say, drinking as you're cooking allows you to do that. What's really important to remember, and as I think one of the panels said earlier, is that there are no right or wrong answers in all of this. You know, wine is incredibly personal. You have your favorites, and you know, in the course of a room today, if we had done a show of hands, you probably would have got 25, 25, 25, 25 on which wine is drinking best for you right now. That's wine. Food is, I believe, even more personal than wine for people because you've got lots more history, lots more memories, lots more depth. So the idea of matching them together is exponentially personal. So as you kind of move through these things, that's one thing. And then as you move through the dish as well, again, remembering ingredients and sauces and all that, how you approach the dish as you scoop your fork across the plate is also going to be a very important factor. Okay? And then certainly, last but not least, Kathy, your dish and your wine thinking?
I am actually different than Renee a little bit. It's like I always start with the wine. Like, and so Mark Vlasic sent me this wine, and I opened it with my sommelier and my chef de cuisine, and we were tasting it, and it's like, it was so, such, it's a big 2007. I mean, it's an amazing wine, but it's very nuanced, and it's like many, many complex layers of flavors. And we started writing all this stuff down, cherry, berry, chocolate, clove, cinnamon, all this stuff, and suddenly I was like transported to the Adriatic Sea, to Venice, and which was the port that on the spice route that all the spices came through from the Orient, and so that decided what dish I was going to do. And as opposed to what Kevin was saying, we usually disagree on most things, food-wise. Disagree, I didn't mean to say that. It's like, I think of lamb and Pinot as going really well together, because Pinot in the Willamette Valley is amazing, and Oregon has really lush pasture, and we have really great lamb. So to me, I've always thought that they just naturally go together. Also, Pinot has a lot of acid, so something that's fatty, like lamb shank, that needs to be cooked for a really long time goes really well with it. But then talking with the winemaker, and with this Venetian Sephardic Jewish influenced dish, I just thought this has to work. I mean, it's like I always approach everything from an Italian point of view, but I thought this is going to really work because this wine is really, really complex. And then Mark suggested, well, what about a little bit of fresh tomato, kind of flash fried? And that's what's on top there. I'm wondering if it works for you. I'd love to hear if it does. And then the beans were speaking. The beans are a purgatorial bean from Ayers Creek Farm in Gaston, Oregon, which is like one of the most amazing farms that we have in Oregon. They grow all kinds of crazy artisan specialty vegetables. And these are an Italian bean from Tuscany that what they grow. And I thought that would match the earthiness that was also in the wine. Mm-hmm. I also want to address the vegetarian dishes. I think we should talk about that. So my vegetarian dish that you have is called Inzimino, and it's not from Venice. It's a Tuscan dish. It's always a dish that's a braised green dish. It's often made with squid, but it can also be made with beans. In this case, they're chickpeas from Spokane, Washington. They're a Food Alliance certified shepherd's grain. It's a cover crop that they grow for their wheat. And that's mixed with fenugreek greens, chard, and dandelion. And there's a little bit of tomato in there as well. There is white wine in there, and onions, carrots, celery. So the root vegetables, too, are something that came up when Mark and I were talking about. So that's the root vegetable-based things, the carrots and the onions and everything. And I hope that it worked.
I think that also one of the things that that Kathy brings up that's important to look at is if you look at the intrinsic personality of it. You know, we've talked about the different aspects of stuff and the cooking methods. It's also important to look at sort of the layering on which foods and wines are based together. Oftentimes, we work at flavor matching. And this is something that's both fun, enjoyable to do when you're trying to connect the, you know, the lemon with the lemongrass with the lemongrass, the kefir lime with the kefir lime, et cetera. But I think for a lot of people, this is what's also scary, because how many flavors are there? Should we start, everybody? Apple, apricot, apple. How long are we going to be here? We could be here for days, and that's just in the world of food. When you connect the world of wine to that, I think for a lot of people who choose to do food and wine, this is why they actually opt out of the equation, because they get incredibly intimidated about it. Having said that, it can be a very valuable tool, and as you become more into it and work with it, matching some of these things, whether or not you're, again, playing off that sort of gamier and more savory Garrigue character that Pinot Noir can pick up, and working with that and the sort of herbal without being herbaceous nature, that's a whole different end of Pinot as opposed to, so obviously, the fruit-driven styles that you can work with as well, too. So, yeah, Whitney? I'm sorry, I can't, I didn't hear you. Yeah, okay, the whole vegetarian concept, your thoughts?
What I do, porcini with parsley, garlic, and a quail egg on top. I always figure mushrooms and Pinot go really great together, and the parsley, I think, matches with the herbaceousness in here, and who doesn't like porcini, so.
Yeah?
You want to run to that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Renee?
Tomorrow.
Mine was a similar lentil salad with the relish tossed into it with celery leaf and a deviled egg, farm egg.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I basically just substituted the lamb in my dish for some lightly blanched haricot vert, tossed with olive oil for some fattiness with the beans, and then a slice of radish to match up with the black pepper that I had with it.
There you go. There you go. I'd be curious to hear what the winemakers thought about the pairings that are there. So in any particular order you want, you'd like to just pick up the microphone and get a sense of what you thought about the pairing that you had with your specific wine.
So as far as I'm concerned, I'm really like the balance because the wine Claude Ferré offer is very delicate. It's not a big wine, very, very delicate. And the food was very precise. And same thing, try to win the delicacy of the wine and to very delicate style of spicy with a back with the wine at the same moment. It was nice to saw that.
A happy camper. Excellent. Lynette?
I thought this was a stunning pairing, actually. I thought it was the best of all of them. I may be a little biased, but I thought it was absolutely awesome. The loin is a subtlety in it. I'm used to lamb that's quite intense flavor from New Zealand, so I like the delicacy of this lamb. But I love the texture that you brought into it by the slight crust of the lamb, the slight charring that gave a really good texture, and the lentils as well, wonderful texture, and brought in the earthiness to the wine that it supported that in the wine. It brought out more of that complexity in the wine. And then the fruit compo was just beautiful. That just really, again, enhanced the fruit. And I just have to say thank you. You made my wine look better.
Great, Lynette.
Maybe you need to have your lambs be a little younger when you get ready. Wonderful pairing. I think the mint was what inspired it. But I have to say, I don't want the recipe, but one of my favorite grape growers is a guy named Mark Pasternak at Devil's Gulch Ranch. He grows lamb for market down in San Francisco. And every year we have 30 people for first Seder at our house, and he brings leg of lamb, and you're invited.
What about the rest of us?
Wonderful.
Great. And Mark?
I was very happy. I think that the combination of the beans and the other components, especially the little bit of cinnamon that worked really nicely to bring out the fruit in the wine, which I think was probably not obvious on first tasting, that the wine had this kind of beautiful, dark, kind of layered fruit. For me, it also emphasized the fact that this is not a big, obvious wine. This is a wine with many layers, and the food kind of also massaged through all of those layers and brought them out in a really beautiful way. Thank you, Kathy.
I hope as we sort of close this portion up and I bring Ray back up to sort of moderate some Q&A here, that what you did find is that aside from the fact that you had four stunningly delicious wines and four stunningly delicious accompaniments there, that they did bring out different aspects of it. You know, as I think Ray said before, you know, wine makes food taste better, food makes wine taste better. That's why he doesn't work for Wine and Scotch magazine, which is got a much lower circulation rate, I believe, than Food and Wine. But the whole goal of an exercise like this is not to necessarily come up with answers, perhaps open up more questions than answers, with probably, again, as I think we all probably agree, the most stunningly diverse red wine to bring to table in Pinot Noir, lamb, which can be equally diverse through cuts, treatments, preparations, spicing, and all that other stuff. And I hope we've evoked your taste buds and your thoughts and all of that. And again, I'll be here with Ray for next few minutes to answer any questions. And I'm around all weekend, so if you want to pull me aside and agree, disagree, have a chat or whatever, happy to do so. Thanks again very much for the opportunity. And a big hand for the chefs.
Big hand for Evan.
No. They did all the heavy lifting.
Evan actually gets to eat now, which is good. So my role here is very simple. I'm going to take questions and pass them along to whoever's talking. But I will say, while we get the microphones going, someone asked about pairing sparkling rosé wine with food. I think that, as with all these, there's always a range of possible options that aren't necessarily similar. The things that popped to mind immediately for me were roast chicken just straightforward roast chicken, especially if you're doing something like Krug Rosé where you don't want anything to get in the way of the Krug. Taste the Krug. Don't, you know, let the Krug be the star. But you could also go with something like, the other thing that popped to mind, strangely enough, was unagi, you know, where you've got eel, which is not a very fishy fish. You've got a little bit of sweetness from the barbecue sauce, and you've got enough rice to kind of ameliorate the flavors and pair that with a fairly robust sparkling wine. So there's lots of play in there. And it's important to remember also that it's very hard to go wrong. You know, you can, you know, if you all of these dishes work pretty well with all the wines. In fact, they all work really well with the wines. They particularly work with the wines they were designed for, but, you know, they're lovely together. And so, you know, be not afraid. Any questions out there for either for our winemakers or for our chefs or for both? Yes, there's a question there.
So one of the things that I noticed here was texture. Especially with the first two wines, it felt like with their food pairings, they really mimicked the texture. And I'm wondering, whoever wants to take this, is that too elevated a theme to talk about when we're not just talking about flavors here, but we're talking about texture? How do you, maybe Ray, as you know, in publications, is that?
It's in no way. I mean, talking about texture in terms of texture, both texture and weight, the sort of tactile components of food and of wine. It's not too elevated to talk about. Occasionally, you'll alienate a few people, you know. But if you start talking about wine tasting like, you know, ripe wild blueberries, you alienate some people right there. They're like, give me a break. In fact, I've found that when I go into coffee stores and I look at the sort of nuanced coffee descriptions, there's an instant reaction in my mind. It's like, what are they talking about? This is obviously ridiculous. No one would do this with wine. So I think texture is hugely important, and I'd be curious to ask any of the chefs if they think about, I mean, I know from the Test Kitchen at Food and Wine that we think about texture a lot, but specifically about texture of different ingredients together, and I'm curious if someone wants to jump in.
Well, I think that it's just...
Can we get the microphone on the guys?
I think when you're thinking about textures with the wine and the food, you're just trying not to overwhelm the wine, you know, so you're tasting it and just keep something in balance, looking for balance.
I would agree. I think when I was thinking of the lamb loin, it's very soft and tender, and so I wanted to have something that was not equally, but not overpowering the texture of it either. I really wanted to have nuts, but we couldn't have nuts, so I was like, all right, fine. But I wanted also something that had an earthiness to match, so that's why I chose the lentils, because they have that nice kind of woody quality. And they're firm, but not hard, so I thought they balanced well with that, but... A lot of times you just kind of see what works and try stuff out and hope it...
I mean, there's a lot of, with wine tasting or cooking, there's a lot of learning that then becomes intuitive. I mean, you go to culinary school or you work for, you know, years in a restaurant, and then things become incorporated in a way that you don't think about them, so you automatically know texturally what will
naturally
work well. By the way, lentils, great secret weapon with red wines. Fantastic accompaniment to almost any meat and red wine because they're so earthy, but they're so savory and they really work well.
Love them, yeah.
These were done in water, not in
with the onions and carrot and celery. Yeah. Just real simple, and then just tossed with olive oil and salt and pepper.
I'd just like to add that texture is a very subliminal thing. I think that, you know, you don't, if you're really paying attention to it, and let's face it, you know, great Pinot Noir is a study in texture. It's a study in creaminess and velvetiness and understanding the way the tannins interplay there. And then if you do, you know, you can be very cognizant of it and address that in your cooking and having something that sort of either one sort of plays edgily against it, but I think to Renee's point, you know, you risk domination factor, and, you know, that might be fun in some circles, but not necessarily in Pinot Noir with food. Just want to see if people are laughing. No, just not. But the other reality is that when they do work, they, you know, again, they're not necessarily, I wouldn't consciously go in unless I was doing a thing for the Zen Center maybe and do an all texture meal or something like that. But you know, when they do work, whether it's similar, you know, creaminess with creaminess, smoothness with smoothness, or the sort of shock and contrast to something that sort of goes crackle and crunch in your mouth against, you know, something bubbly and effervescent like a champagne, texture can be a huge attribute in pairing because it hits on a different whole sensory area of your brain that not necessarily the tactile part as opposed to simply purely the gustatory part.
It's also, I mean, this may have come up when you were talking earlier, but, you know, there's both complementary things and contrasting things can be valuable in pairing. Sometimes you want the You know, you want acidity versus sweetness. Sometimes you want sweetness with sweetness. And I think, you know, when you talk about blackberries, it was too blackberry to have them all together. It's kind of one of those, it's somewhat nuanced, but you might think, blackberries, blackberries, so that sounds perfect. It's obviously a perfect pairing. But in fact, then you get this sort of monochrome note, and you might like something that's a little more red fruit to contrast. Another question out there. Yeah, right there. For the winemakers, the question, very simple, what is the rough retail price of those wines? Someone want to jump in? I'm afraid that the winemaker, some of these winemakers are going to know the answer to that and some aren't. They're artists. They don't worry about money.
So I think it's a very hard question. I think it's around $75-$85 per bottle.
I certainly do worry about money. And I think around $40 to $45 US.
About $55 US. And I'm not allowed to touch money nor talk about it, but I will today.
It's $36 to $38.
You know, it's a funny thing. Dan and I were talking at the table. It's one of the, and I said earlier that, you know, there's this eternal quest for inexpensive Pinot Noir that tastes like Pinot Noir, which is very hard to find because Pinot Noir is hard to grow. It's low yielding. It's, you know, but so finding cheap Pinot Noir is difficult. However, finding Pinot Noir at the sort of, $25 to $50 zone that's really terrific is actually pretty doable. And people forget that when, you know, they sort of think of, you know, high-end Pinots as being expensive. But in fact, compared to Cabernet or something, it's kind of a bargain for what you're getting, in both in terms of pleasure immediately and pleasure in terms of aging. All these wines will age gorgeously. I think that's pretty clear. Another question out there? Yeah. I'll repeat it and it's not a dumb question. It's actually it's a great question. And the question was, when you're tasting wine and food together, what's the ideal progression? Do you taste the wine first? Do you chew the food first? I can tell you one thing you don't do is spit the food into the spit bucket, because that really alienates all the servers in a big way. So
yeah,
go give this on me.
My experience has been that you, two things. One, whenever possible, that's not always possible, although it is 99% of the time, and if you can control it, make it happen, always do take the time to try the wine by itself before the food comes out. That's what always drives me crazy, and my single biggest slap to oftentimes restaurants is that you've ordered your food, and the food comes out, and then the wine comes out afterwards, and you've missed half of that opportunity. So always insist that you get your wine first. Secondarily, I believe actually in sandwiching the food between the wine. So have the wine, get an understanding of its flavors and of its finish, then get the food and its attack, and then finish with the attack of the wine on the food too. So you really get a 360 around the food with the wine. I wouldn't do that all the time for every single bite, because you'll drive yourself crazy. Yeah. But at one point, if you're really trying to get a sense of how it works in its totality, sandwich the food between sips of wine and pay attention to that aspect of
it. Yeah, as is typical, the wine does prepare you for the next bite as well. It clears your palate. And that way you get to drink twice as much wine as well, which is extremely important. I think the timing, we're sort of reaching the end of things. Do we have time for one more question? Yeah. A quick question. Who's got a quick question? What's the meaning of life? Yes. Sourcing lamb. Right. Basically, how do you get great lamb? So the question was, how do you source great lamb? Some lamb will be tougher and more fibery. Some lamb will be more tender. Unfortunately, I can tell you one thing with the way the world works is that babies are more tender. it's a rough truth. So that's why that spring lamb in Rome is so good. Any of the chefs who want to talk about sourcing?
Do you have access to farmer's market? I think go find a guy who's selling lamb, and hopefully it's the guy raising the lamb, and just hang out with them. And if you like the lamb, come back next week.
Yeah. And the other thing is, again, is like lush tall grass all year long. That's what lamb loves.
Yeah, that's grass-fed. So that grass-fed terminology is not actually, I mean, if they actually are eating the grass, it's a good thing. I would second know your source. That's becoming so important in food if you want really great food is, you know, go to the farmer's market, so you buy a leg of lamb at one point from some guy and it's not that good. Well, maybe you skip to the next guy down the line who's not feeding his lamb bolts or something, you know. You build that relationship. I think it's much in the same way that you build a relationship with a winery and a wine. You know, when you have a personal connection to it, it tastes all the better. That's why people are so tied to wineries they visit. You know, especially if it's the honeymoon or something. You know, all those wines taste great because of context. And I think that knowing a farmer, meeting them, talking to them, you know, really does change your appreciation and understanding of the food you're eating. And then you can start raising it yourself. And then you can start slaughtering it yourself. We're going to, on that cheery note, I think we're going to wrap up. Can I have a huge hand of applause for our winemakers, our chefs, for Evan? Thank you all. We've got a whole weekend ahead of us. Pretty great.
I don't know about you guys, but I thought that was pretty incredible as far as the degree of complexity of those dishes and the amount of work that went in there and the fabulous wine. So once again, fabulous job. But the truth of the matter is that what you just had was not your lunch. That was more like an amuse-bouche, which is pretty unusual before lunch. So consider it as your first lunch. And so second lunch actually is being served right in the Oak Grove, which is just across the way here shortly. So we're going to be proceeding over there as soon as we finish up here, which will be momentarily. And I also wanted to just do, again, a little bit of business, but there's some afternoon optional seminars to be attended. And so the Oregon AVA tasting has actually been moved to Jonathan Hall, which is on the bottom floor of Melrose, and it has easy ramp access, and it's right near Riley Walker, the lawn over there. So so that's a little move. But anyhow, let's go ahead and finish up tasting little bits here, and we'll start moving over for lunch. So on to second lunch.